What, us worry?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Wall Street is generally filled with worriers. They worry about retail sales. They worry about inflation, oil prices, corporate profits. But when things don't turn out as bad as they expected, investors get really happy. Stocks they sold with abandon yesterday are bought up like they're the last shares on earth today. This morning, J.P. Morgan Chase said profits fell 53% in the second quarter. But J.P.'s shares are up, and bank stocks are rallying across the board. Things weren't as bad as expected. Marketplace's Steve Henn has a little Psych 101.
Wall Street's glee over a wave of bad financial reports may seem counterintuitive to us, but James Engel, a business professor at Georgetown University, says it all makes perfect sense.
The thing about the market is it's always trying to look two or three steps ahead, so that if people are anticipating a particular bit of bad news, when the news finally comes out, at least it wasn't worse than we were expecting, so that in itself is, paradoxically, good news.
So if bad news can be good news, could good news be bad news? Well, yeah. Pretend for a second we all got big, fat raises this month, so we could cope with high fuel bills and surging food costs. That would make inflation worse, and Mark Zandi at Economy.com says markets would freak.
Because the Reserve would tighten monetary policy, rates would rise, and that would hurt.
And it wouldn't just hurt Wall Street, it would hurt Main Street, too. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. So far, the Dow is up 84 points to 11,324. The NASDAQ has gained 18, and the S&P 500 has added 10 points. Investors are very happy in Europe. They're buying bank stocks in droves. The markets are up 3%. 1% to 2% gains in Asia by the close. Oil is at $134 a barrel. Oil companies lease land for drilling, but sometimes they don't do anything with the land. They just sit on it. But today, the House considers a bill that would force companies to use it or lose it. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The bill claims oil companies are sitting on some 68 million acres of federal leases, both on land and offshore, that have yet to produce a single drop of crude. But Sarah Banaszak with the American Petroleum Institute says there's a reason.
Leases don't come with MapQuest directions that say drill here for 50 million barrels. It takes a process of exploration.
Banaszak says developing an oil lease, especially offshore, can take up to 10 years and cost as much as $1 billion. Money, she says, oil companies may not be willing to risk if the use-it-or-lose-it legislation passes. But Phil Sharp with the energy think tank Resources for the Future says the bill isn't about boosting domestic oil supply. It's about making a statement.
And the statement here appears to be that there is next to nothing that the government can aggressively do that can quickly change the world price of oil.
He says expanding offshore oil production may pay off in the long term, but it's far from a solution for today's high gas prices. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The European Union has agreed to extend music royalties from 50 years to 95 years. The Parliament still has to approve it. But it would mean the Beatles, The Who, and others will still be getting paid when they're 104. Paul McCartney and Roger Daltrey pushed for this. They were apparently looking out for their fellow aging rockers. But seriously, what rock star is going to live that long? This is the Morning Report for Thursday, July 17th on Marketplace.org. Let's see, we've covered the stock markets, the Dow, the NASDAQ, all that. Maybe we should check on the Champagne Index. Yes, there is one. Stephen Beard has more from London.
The S&P 500 is down almost 15%, but one index is soaring and singing and dancing. The LIVEX Champagne Index is up 27%. The index tracks the price of the world's top vintages. The Krug 96, for example, is up by 56%. A case of that now costs almost $5,000. Champagne's staggering performance is mostly due to the fact that more newly rich people are quaffing it, Russian oligarchs and Chinese entrepreneurs. But, says Justin Gibbs of LIVEX, sales are holding up well even in doom-laden Western markets.
Champagne is one of those wines associated with celebration, and people look for reasons to celebrate when things aren't looking so good, perhaps.
More and more investors have been drawn to vintage champagne, pushing prices even higher. And, says one commentator, even if the market collapses, they can always uncork their investment and drink it. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's kind of hard to think about winter heating when it's 95 degrees out. But think about it, we must, as fuel costs keep climbing. People in the Northwest could pay as much as 40% more than last year. From Portland, Oregon, Mitchell Hartman reports.
There's significantly less natural gas in storage right now than a year ago. Jim Williams follows energy markets at WTRG Economics.
For 2 years, we have had very high natural gas stocks. And because of that, natural gas prices have been relatively low compared to crude oil.
Now, the equation is reversed. Because oil is so expensive, industries that can switch to natural gas are grabbing what they can. You and I are competing with electric utilities, and that pushes the price up for everyone. Penny-pinching consumers could turn their thermostats down. Williams reckons crude oil prices could fall too, taking pressure off natural gas.
I think that it is more likely than not that prices will ease by winter, but right now it's sort of like rolling the dice.
Even if gas bills don't go through the roof, consumers are sure to be paying a good deal more than they did last year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Libel cases are pretty tough to win in the United States. We have that First Amendment thing. But in other countries, libel laws can be pretty lax. So when the rich and powerful want to sue for libel, they go shopping for a legal system. There's even a name for it, libel tourism. Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
In the olden days, a man's reputation was everything, and if someone said or wrote something that sullied his good name, there was one way to sort it out.
Gentlemen, are you ready? Fire!
Eventually, dueling was replaced by a less deadly method of comeuppance, libel law. But thanks to the internet, writing can still be a dangerous profession. John Watson teaches communication law and journalism ethics at American University.
Now, with the globalization of communication, if someone impugns your reputation in New York, it's essentially done simultaneously throughout the globe.
That means aggrieved plaintiffs can sue pretty much anywhere. Often they choose Britain, where laws tend to favor the allegedly libeled. New York-based author Rachel Ehrenfeld is an expert on terrorism financing. In 2003, she wrote a book called Funding Evil. In it, she implied that a Saudi businessman, Sheikh Khalid bin Mahfouz, was funneling money to terrorist groups. Bin Mahfouz sued her for libel in London. A defiant Ehrenfeld refused to show up. Bin Mahfouz won by default.
I was fined $225,000. I was ordered to destroy the books, to publish apologies in all the major newspapers.
Ehrenfeld tried to countersue in the US. Ultimately, the American court wouldn't take the case. Other authors and publications faced with the possibility of losing a libel case have issued apologies and pulped entire print runs. American University's John Watson says this backing down to save money makes a mockery of journalism ethics and threatens the truth.
The entire purpose of the First Amendment is being subverted to commercial processes and commercial processes that are supported by law. And that's very frightening to me.
This spring, New York took some notice. The state passed the Libel Terrorism Protection Act. The law protects any New York writer from having their assets seized if they lose a libel case abroad. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
A European vacation sounds pretty good right now, if you can afford it. Amsterdam is still one of the biggest draws for its canals, art museums, other things. Actually, the city is trying to clean things up a bit. Brett Neely has our story.
Amsterdam's Red Light District is an amusement park of sin. In red-lit storefront windows, barely dressed prostitutes pose seductively and try to lure customers. But lately, some of the windows have stopped showing off skin. One window displays the latest haute couture from fashion designer Conny Groenewegen. She says the location is perfect.
When I walk through this neighborhood and I see the designers' windows and then I see the naked girls, somehow it's complementary to each other. So you can fit the dresses on the girls, you know, imaginary.
Connie is in the Red Light District thanks to a new city-sponsored program called Red Light Fashion. She pays less than $250 a month for her window, a tenth of what the rent would otherwise be. 16 young designers have moved into former prostitution windows. Interior decorators and artists will soon join them. Edwin Opedijk works for the city of Amsterdam. He says the Red Light District was getting too sleazy.
There were too many coffee shops, too many brothels, too much of the same thing.
Last year, the city helped broker a deal to buy property all over the area. A notorious landlord who was allegedly involved with human trafficking walked off with 25 million euros, so long as he promised to leave for good. Other landlords have been getting similar offers. As a result, almost 20% of the prostitution windows in the area have been taken out of commission. Opedijk says Amsterdam isn't trying to outlaw prostitution, but the district's future lies in going upscale.
It will be nice restaurants, fashion stores, erotic entertainment with coffee shops.
But the process, which involves paying millions to landlords to entice them to leave, strikes many of the neighborhood's prostitutes as unfair. Yokita Homa is with the nonprofit Prostitution Information Center.
They get millions of euros for that, but the people who work behind the windows are the ones to live with the consequences.
She says that gentrification is increasing the competition for windows and that rents will rise for the neighborhood's prostitutes. It's a phenomenon almost as old as the world's oldest profession. In Amsterdam's Red Light District, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
American Public Media.